This is the April-May-June 2022 Criminal Law Update CLE. It's based on the summaries of criminal law decisions that were posted on the New York Appellate Digest in April, May, and June. Those summaries have been collected into monthly reversal reports, and the three monthly reversal reports are the written materials for this course. The page numbers referred to in the recording are the pages of those three reversal reports, and obviously each report starts with page one. The CLE is divided into three parts. We're going to start with the April 2022 Criminal Law Reversal Report. On pages four and five, the first case is People versus Bradford. It's an appellate issue, and the dissent has the most interesting argument. The Fourth Department affirmed the summary denial of defendant's motion to vacate his conviction on ineffective assistance grounds. Defendant argued his counsel was ineffective because counsel did not object to defendants being forced to wear a stun belt. The two-justice dissent noted that the ground on which the majority based this decision, that being that the defense counsel's failure to object did not rise to ineffective assistance, was not the ground relied on by the motion court. Therefore, the dissent argued the appellate court could not affirm on that ground. And this is from the dissent. The court summarily denied the motion, concluding in relevant part that defendant is not entitled to relief on his ineffective assistance of counsel claim because we determined on direct appeal that he was not deprived of effective assistance of counsel. The majority affirms that ruling on another ground, one not argued by the people on appeal, namely that defense counsel's failure to object to the stun belt standing alone was not such an egregious or prejudicial error as to compromise defendant's right to a fair trial. Because the court did not deny defendant's motion on the ground relied upon by the majority, we are precluded from affirming on that ground. And that was from the dissent. So the takeaway here, although the argument was made in the dissent in this case, it is worth noting that there is authority for the position that an appellate court cannot affirm on a ground not relied upon by the lower court. Next is People ex rel Steinagel, or Steinagel, on pages 5 and 6. The issue here was whether the failure to follow the correct procedure in setting bail can be a proper subject for a habeas corpus petition, and the Fourth Department found that it is a proper subject of a habeas corpus petition. The Fourth Department, remitting the matter, held that although bail setting is not appealable, the habeas corpus petition was the proper vehicle for a review of whether the constitutional or statutory standards inhibiting excessive bail were met. Here it was alleged the bail-setting court did not comply with Criminal Procedure Law 510.30 by explaining its finding that remand was the least restrictive option. The court wrote, after considering all of the relevant factors under Criminal Procedure Law 510.30, the bail-setting court determined that remand was the least restrictive condition. We conclude that the bail-setting court failed to comply with the statutory mandate of Criminal Procedure Law 510.10 because it failed to explain its choice of release with conditions, bail or remand, on the record or in writing. We therefore reverse the judgment, reinstate the petition, and grant the petition in part, and we remit the matter to the bail-setting court for further proceedings to satisfy the requirements of CPL 510.10. So the takeaway, although bail setting is not appealable, a habeas corpus petition can be used to argue the bail setting court did not comply with the constitutional or statutory standards inhibiting excessive bail. Here, the court's failure to explain its choice to remand the defendant violated Criminal Procedure Law 510.30. Next is People v. Sherwood on pages 6 and 7. It's a Brady violation case. Here, the defense didn't receive the Brady material until they issued a subpoena, and the Brady material was provided 4 days before trial. The court said it wasn't reversible error basically finding that the defense was not prejudiced by the error or the omission. Third Department, over a dissent, held that the people's failure to turn over Brady material in this sexual offense prosecution, which the defense received 4 days before trial pursuant to a subpoena, did not require reversal. The court wrote, "While the people unquestionably have a duty to disclose exculpatory material in their control, a defendant's constitutional right to a fair trial is not violated when, as here, he or she is given a meaningful opportunity to use the allegedly exculpatory material to cross-examine the people's witnesses or as evidence during his or her case. Defendant, by way of a subpoena, received the records from the victim's evaluation 4 days before trial. Defendant asserts that these records contain two pieces of allegedly exculpatory information. The first is that a physical examination of the victim performed 3 months after the incident was normal and did not reveal any injury. The second is that the victim, during an interview related to the physical examination, disclosed allegations of prior sexual abuse by two different individuals, which defendant asserts were fabricated." And the dissent wrote, "In my view, the withheld evidence was clearly material, and defendant was prejudiced. As a result of the Brady violation, defendant was denied an opportunity to pursue other strategies with defense counsel. He was denied, among other things, the opportunity to investigate and interview other potential defense witnesses well in advance of trial, or to develop a more detailed argument on the issue of whether he could cross-examine the victim and call certain witnesses without running afoul of the rape shield law, which is Criminal Procedure Law 60.42. With more time, he also could have called the examining physician or retained his own medical expert to review the records. Learning of the existence of potential witnesses, such as the victim's brother and the mother's landlord, a mere 4 days before trial, provided defendant no opportunity to locate and interview these witnesses and possibly incorporate their testimony into his defense. Moreover, as county court noted, defendant under these circumstances was under no obligation to seek an adjournment of the trial." That was from the dissent. So the takeaway here, although the Brady material was not provided until 4 days before trial pursuant to a defense subpoena, reversal was not required because the majority held the defense had a meaningful opportunity to use the material in the cross-examination of the people's witnesses. Next is People v. Palombi, pages 7 and 8, and it discusses the concept of criminal negligence in the context of an assault arising from an automobile accident. The Fourth Department, reversing defendant's conviction and dismissing the indictment, held the criminal negligence element of assault third was not proven. Defendant was driving with a passenger when he crossed into the oncoming lane, pulled back into his lane, lost control, and crashed, injuring the passenger. The court wrote, "In cases involving criminal negligence arising out of automobile accidents involving excess rates of speed, such as here, it takes some additional affirmative act by the defendant to transform speeding into dangerous speeding. With respect to the issue of defendant's rate of speed, the trial testimony from the prosecution's expert witness that the defendant was driving at the excessive speed of approximately 92 miles per hour at the time of the incident was speculative. The expert's calculation of the vehicle's speed was based on the assumption of 100% braking, but there was no evidence that defendant braked at all before his vehicle collided with the mailbox, tree, and utility pole and came to a stop. The people's version of the events, that defendant deliberately attempted to flatten out the curve by crossing the double line of the curve, does not rise to the level of moral blameworthiness to constitute criminal negligence." So the takeaway here, in the context of an assault third charge alleging a car accident was the result of defendant's criminal negligence, proof of speeding, as opposed to proof of dangerous speeding, will not support a conviction. This case is a good example of legally sufficient evidence resulting in a conviction which is determined on appeal to be against the weight of the evidence. The expert evidence presented to show the speed at which defendant was driving was speculative and based upon an unproved assumption. That evidence was too weak to support a conviction, thereby rendering the conviction against the weight of the evidence. Next is Matter of Hogan on pages 8 and 9. It's an inmate disciplinary hearing case. The inmate was charged with creating a disturbance, and the Third Department found that the evidence did not support the charge. Third Department, annulling the disciplinary determination, held the evidence didn't demonstrate petitioner inmate was guilty of creating a disturbance. The court wrote, pursuant to the relevant regulations, an incarcerated individual shall not engage in conduct which disturbs the order of any part of the facility. Such disruptive conduct includes loud talking in a mess hall, program area, or corridor. The misbehavior report, which was the sole evidence relied upon by the hearing officer, provided that petitioner was observed arguing with another incarcerated individual in the dorm hallway, which drew the attention of the incarcerated individuals nearby. The misbehavior report does not reflect that petitioner was screaming or otherwise speaking in a loud or boisterous manner, nor does it establish that petitioner's behavior triggered an affirmative response on the part of the incarcerated individuals observing the alleged argument. Petitioner was found not guilty of fighting, and there were no other established disciplinary infractions that would give rise to a reasonable inference that his conduct was disruptive. As the misbehavior report fails to identify the manner in which petitioner's conduct disturbed the order of the facility, we cannot say that respondent's determination is supported by substantial evidence. Next is People v. Escobales on pages 9 and 10. It's a criminal discovery case where the people were seeking a protective order to keep certain discovery from the defense until shortly before trial. The Third Department, modifying the protective order upon an expedited review pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law, Section 245-70, determined that defense counsel should have been provided with the people's application to withhold certain discoverable materials from the defendant until a week before trial. The court wrote, inasmuch as the people offered no basis to withhold these materials from defense counsel, and in fact, pursuant to the proposed order submitted by the people, defense counsel would be permitted to access them as soon as county court signed the order, the better practice would have been to permit defense counsel access to the application and materials prior to the hearing on the protective order, so that counsel could participate in it to the fullest extent practicable. Defense counsel should, with the appropriate caveat, not to disclose them to or discuss their contents with his client pending determination of the application, be permitted to view the application and the materials at issue, and thereby meaningfully participate in the hearing before county court in order to advocate on behalf of his client and assist in reaching an appropriate outcome. Accordingly, the instant application should be granted and the matter remitted for a new hearing following further disclosure to defense counsel. So the takeaway here, county court should have disclosed to the defense the people's application to withhold certain discoverable materials from the defendant until a week before trial. Without the application, defense counsel could not fully litigate the issues. Next is People v. Alim on page 10. Here the Fourth Department, reversing the conviction and dismissing the count, noted that refusing to take a DWI breath test is not an offense. The court simply said, we note that defendant's refusal to submit to a breath test did not establish a cognizable offense. Next is People v. Gardner. On pages 11 and 12, it raises two issues. Whether a written statement by a witness should have been admitted as past recollection recorded, and whether the jury instruction on accomplice liability prejudiced the defendant. The Fourth Department, reversing defendant's conviction and ordering a new trial, held 1. A written statement by a prosecution witness should not have been admitted as past recollection recorded, and 2. The jury instruction on accomplice liability prejudiced the defendant. The jury instruction error was not preserved, but was considered on appeal in the interest of justice. The court wrote, the foundational requirements for the admissibility of a past recollection recorded are 1. The witness must have observed the matter recorded. 2. The recollection must have been fairly fresh at the time when it was recorded. 3. The witness must currently be able to testify that the record is a correct representation of his or her knowledge and recollection at the time it was made. And 4. The witness must lack sufficient present recollection of the information recorded. The prosecution witness in question did not testify that his written statement accurately represented his knowledge and recollection when made. To the contrary, the witness testified that the statement was not accurate when given because he was under the influence of narcotics at that time. Because the statement was made more than 6 months after the events recorded in the statement, the recollection was not fairly fresh when recorded. And now the court is addressing the accomplice liability jury instruction. Penal Law Section 20 provides that a person is criminally liable for the conduct of another when, acting with the mental culpability required for the commission thereof, he solicits, requests, commands, importunes, or intentionally aids such person to engage in such conduct. We conclude that the court's use of the phrase potentially aids rather than intentionally aids significantly prejudiced defendant who was alleged to have aided and abetted the principal by driving him to and from the crime scene. So the takeaway here, the written statement did not meet the criteria for admissibility as past recollection recorded. The witness testified the statement was not accurate when given because he was high, and the statement was not fresh because it was made 6 months after the events described in it. And the other issue was whether the court, using the phrase potentially aids rather than intentionally aids in the jury instruction for accomplice liability, prejudiced the defendant, and the court found that the mistake was prejudicial. Next is People v. Hartsfield on pages 12 and 13. It deals with whether the evidence that defendant had been incarcerated before was properly admitted. The Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, held that if it was error to admit testimony that the rape victim was aware defendant had been incarcerated, the error was harmless. The dissenters argued that the victim's state of mind, that being the awareness of defendant's prior incarceration, was irrelevant because the victim was immediately overpowered and pushed to the floor upon opening the door for the defendant. And this quote now is from the dissent. The evidence had no probative value under the circumstances of this case and should have been excluded as prejudicial. So the takeaway here, the two dissenters argued that evidence the rape victim was aware defendant had been incarcerated should not have been admitted because it was irrelevant and highly prejudicial. The evidence, according to the dissenters, was irrelevant because the victim's state of mind was not an issue. She was immediately overpowered by the defendant as soon as she opened the door. Next is Matter of Sapphire, page 13. It's a family law case, a neglect action, and it's here because of the effect of legalizing marijuana use. The First Department, reversing family court, held mother's marijuana use during pregnancy and the fact that mother and the child tested positive for marijuana at the time of birth were insufficient to demonstrate neglect. The court wrote, the evidence that the mother smoked marijuana while pregnant with her youngest daughter and that the mother and child both tested positive for marijuana at the time of the birth is insufficient in and of itself to sustain a finding that the child was physically, mentally, or emotionally impaired, or was in imminent danger of being impaired. Here, as acknowledged by the agency, there was no evidence that the mother's marijuana use impacted her judgment or behavior, or that the child was impaired or placed in imminent risk of impairment by the mother's drug use. The finding of neglect based solely on use of marijuana without a finding of actual or imminent impairment of the child's physical or emotional condition is inconsistent with this state's public policy legalizing marijuana, as reflected in the recent amendment to the Family Court Act, and that's Family Court Act Section 1046. So the takeaway here, because marijuana use has been legalized, proof mother smoked marijuana and mother and child tested positive for marijuana at the time of birth was not enough to demonstrate neglect. There must be proof, for example, that mother's judgment was affected or the child was harmed in some way. Next is People versus Mother Cell on pages 14 and 15. It deals with a promise which induced a guilty plea, but which could not, in fact, be honored. The Fourth Department, vacating defendant's sentence in the interest of justice, held the defendant's guilty plea was induced by the judge's promise defendant could appeal from all the court's orders. In fact, by pleading guilty, defendant could not appeal the order rejecting his argument that the first two counts of the indictment were duplicitous. The court wrote, "We agree with defendant that his plea was not knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently entered. Although defendant failed to preserve that contention for our review, we exercise our power to review it as a matter of discretion in the interest of justice. A trial court is constitutionally required to ensure that a defendant, before entering a guilty plea, has a full understanding of what the plea entails and its consequences. And where a guilty plea has been induced by an unfulfilled promise, the plea must be vacated or the promise must be honored." Here the court repeatedly promised defendant, who was proceeding pro se, that he would retain the right to appeal from all of its orders. The court reiterated that promise during the plea colloquy and did not advise defendant that he was forfeiting any challenge by pleading guilty. We conclude that by pleading guilty, defendant forfeited his contention that the first two counts in the indictment were duplicitous. Inasmuch as the record establishes that defendant, in accepting the plea, relied on a promise of the court that could not, as a matter of law, be honored, defendant is entitled to vacatur of his guilty plea. So the takeaway here, the defendant's guilty plea was induced by the judge's promise that all the court's orders could be appealed. In fact, the guilty plea precluded raising on appeal defendant's contention that two indictment counts were duplicitous. Even though this issue was not preserved for appeal, the Fourth Department vacated the guilty plea. Next is People versus Malloy on page 15. It deals with whether in a criminal case a judge can preclude a defendant from making further applications to the court without the court's permission. The Third Department noted that the judge who denied defendant's second motion to set aside his sentence should not have precluded defendant from making additional applications without the permission of the court. The court wrote, "We agree with defendant that county court abused its discretion in ordering that prior court approval was required before any further motions were filed. The authority cited by county court, which is 22 NYCRR Part 130-1.1, by its own terms, applies only to civil actions or proceedings. Even if such authority does exist in a criminal action, defendant has not engaged in sufficiently excessive, protracted, or unwarranted litigation as to justify such an action here." So here the court abused its discretion in prohibiting defendant, who had made two motions to set aside his sentence, from making additional motions without permission from the court, and it's questionable whether a judge has that authority on the criminal as opposed to the civil side. Next is People v. Aponte, pages 16 and 17. The conviction here was reversed in the interest of justice because of the judge's excessive interference in the trial. The Second Department, reversing defendant's murder, assault, and weapon possession convictions in the interest of justice, held the judge improperly restricted defense counsel's summation and evidence submissions, and improperly allowed hearsay identification evidence which supported the people's theory. Identification of the shooter was the key issue, and the eyewitness accounts were inconsistent and contradictory. The judge prohibited defense counsel from questioning the fairness of the identification procedure, which was a lineup, in summation, and repeatedly interposed objections during the defense summation in the absence of any objection by the prosecutor. The court wrote, "The Supreme Court's limitation of the defendant's cross-examination of the police witness and its sua sponte admonishments to defense counsel during summation improperly limited the defendant's right to challenge the lineup procedures as unfair and suggestive. The court erred in informing the jury and the parties in front of the jury that it had already determined that the pretrial identification procedure was fair and not suggestive, and that the lineup was constitutional, wrongly intimating that those facts were not within the jury's province to determine." The Supreme Court also substantially impaired the defendant's right to make an effective closing argument through sua sponte objection sustained interruptions without any actual objection being posited by the people. Supreme Court also erred in admitting into evidence the hearsay statement of an unidentified woman that a man wearing all gray had the firearm as an excited utterance exception to the hearsay rule. The record contained no evidence from which a trier of fact could infer that the statement was based on the woman's personal observation. Supreme Court should have granted defendant's application to admit into evidence the photographs of the defendant and another party who was also at the scene to allow the jury to compare their likenesses, since under the circumstances of this case, such evidence was highly probative of the defense of third-party culpability and plainly outweighed any danger of delay, prejudice, and confusion. Next is People v. Ledesma, pages 17 and 18. This is a voir dire case. First Department, reversing defendant's sexual abuse conviction, held the judge should have inquired further when several prospective jurors indicated they would be inclined to believe the victim. And the following is from the voir dire. This is what prospective juror Mr. L. said. "I would say that I do think that there is a lot of disincentives to come forward at all. And to come forward to this point, it would surprise me that someone would get that far without there being anything at all to it." And the court said, okay. Then the following is from one of the attorneys. "I know some of you raised your hand. Who agrees with the statement that Mr. L. just said?" At that time, five jurors raised their hands. The court wrote, "This statement by prospective juror Mr. L. and the apparent agreement by the other prospective jurors who raised their hands was sufficient to raise a serious doubt regarding the ability to be impartial. The court erred in not engaging in any further inquiry of those jurors in order to elicit an unequivocal assurance of their impartiality and their ability to follow the court's instructions." So the takeaway here, in this sexual abuse case, five prospective jurors agreed with a prospective juror who said he would be inclined to believe the victim because of how hard it is to come forward. The judge should have made further inquiries and a new trial was ordered. Next is People v. Heiserman on page 19. The issue was whether the justification defense jury instruction should have been given. Apparently the defendant punched a police officer immediately after being sprayed with pepper spray. The Third Department, reversing defendant's conviction and ordering a new trial over a two-justice dissent, held the justification defense jury instruction should have been given in this assault case. The defendant punched a police officer after the defendant was sprayed in the face with pepper spray. The court wrote, "The people introduced into evidence a video recording of the assault in which defendant can clearly be seen punching a police sergeant after defendant is sprayed in the face with pepper spray. Testimony revealed and the video corroborated that the pepper spray was deployed because defendant was refusing to take off his shoes and change into footwear provided by the jail so that an officer could finish searching him before bringing him into the jail. The video depicts a very brief time period between the initial directive for defendant to remove his footwear and the deployment of the pepper spray. Based on this fact, combined with other circumstances surrounding the incident, we find that there's a reasonable view of the evidence that the use of the pepper spray constituted excessive force in this scenario." So the takeaway here, there was evidence the police officers spraying defendant in the face with pepper spray constituted the use of excessive force. Defendant punched the police officer after the defendant was sprayed and was charged with assault. The failure to instruct the jury on the justification defense was reversible error, and there were two dissenters. Next is People v. Joseph on page 20. Here, the Second Department, vacating the sentence and dismissing the count, held that burglary second is a lesser included concurrent count of burglary first. The court wrote, "The defendant's conviction of burglary in the second degree under Penal Law Section 140.25, Subdivision 2, as well as the sentence imposed, must be vacated and that count dismissed as a lesser included concurrent count of burglary in the first degree under Penal Law Section 140.30, Subdivision 4. And it cites Criminal Procedure Law, Section 300.40, Subdivision 3B. Next is People v. Ginty, pages 20 and 21. Here the issue was whether a pat-down search after a vehicle stop was justified by reasonable suspicion that the defendant was armed. Fourth Department, over a dissent, held the police officer's observations of defendant inside the stopped vehicle were sufficient to raise a reasonable suspicion the defendant was armed, which justified the pat-down search. The dissent argued that the proof presented at the suppression hearing did not meet the reasonable suspicion standard. The court wrote, "Although the dissent suggests otherwise, the fact that the officer's view of defendant was obscured to some extent when defendant was partially concealed inside the vehicle and was observed surreptitiously reaching toward his waistband constitutes a circumstance that supports a reasonable suspicion that defendant was armed or posed a threat to officer safety." The dissent wrote, "Reasonable suspicion may not rest on equivocal or innocuous behavior that is susceptible of an innocent as well as a culpable interpretation. Inasmuch as defendant's nervousness and movements were susceptible of an innocent interpretation, particularly in light of his status as the vehicle's only black occupant, and inasmuch as defendant was, according to the officer's testimony, fully compliant with the officer's instruction to exit the vehicle, I agree with defendant that his conduct while in the vehicle was insufficient to establish reasonable suspicion necessary for law enforcement to conduct a pat frisk of his person." So the takeaway here, although only the dissent felt this analysis applied here, a person's equivocal or innocuous behavior like nervousness or shaking does not support a reasonable suspicion that a person is armed. Next is People v. Burgess, page 21. And the issue here was whether the sentence for the weapon possession charge must be concurrent with the sentences for the shooting-related convictions. Second Department held the sentence for weapon possession should be concurrent with the sentences for the shooting-related convictions. The court wrote, "The sentence imposed on the conviction of criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree should not run consecutively to the concurrent sentences imposed on the convictions of manslaughter in the first degree and attempted murder in the second degree. The evidence at trial failed to establish that the defendant's possession of a gun was separate and distinct from his shooting at the two victims, resulting in the death of one of them. So the takeaway here, unless the possession of a weapon charge is somehow distinct and separate from the possession of the weapon used in the shooting, the sentences for the possession of the weapon and the shooting-related convictions should be concurrent. Next is People v. Brown on page 22, another case dealing with concurrent versus consecutive sentencing. Fourth Department held the sentences for assault first and robbery first should not have been imposed consecutively. The court wrote, "The court erred in directing that the sentences on the count of assault in the first degree run consecutively to the sentence imposed on the count of robbery in the first degree because the robbery was the predicate felony for the felony assault," and it cites Penal Law Section 70.25, Subdivision 2. "Inasmuch as the felony upon which felony assault is predicated is a material element of that crime, the sentence imposed on the count of assault in the first degree must run concurrently with the sentence imposed on the count of robbery in the first degree." So the takeaway here, when one felony, here it was robbery first, is a predicate felony for another, here it was assault first, the sentence for the two crimes must run concurrently. Next is People v. Ellis on pages 23 and 24. It's a Sex Offense Registration Act case, Fourth Department, reducing defendant's risk level from 3 to 2, held the people did not prove defendant engaged in a continuous course of sexual misconduct, which requires that the acts be at least 24 hours apart. The court wrote, "The court erred in assessing 20 points under risk factor 4 for having engaged in a continuous course of sexual misconduct. Points may be assessed under risk factor 4 if the people establish by clear and convincing evidence defendant engaged in two or more acts of sexual contact, at least one of which is an act of sexual intercourse, oral sexual conduct, anal sexual conduct, or aggravated sexual contact, which acts are separated in time by at least 24 hours. Here, although the people presented evidence defendant engaged in acts of sexual contact with the victim on more than one occasion, they didn't establish when these acts occurred relative to each other, and thus failed to demonstrate that such instances were separated in time by at least 24 hours. So the takeaway here, a 20-point Sex Offender Registration Act assessment for a continuous course of sexual misconduct requires proof the acts took place at least 24 hours apart. Here there was no proof of when the acts occurred relative to each other. Therefore, the 20-point assessment was struck. Next is People v. Gardner on pages 24 and 25. It's the last case in the April 2022 Criminal Law Reversal Report. The issue is whether a 21-year delay violated the defendant's right to a speedy trial. Second Department held that the 21-year delay between the crime, which was rape, and defendant's arrest did not violate the defendant's right to a speedy trial. The court wrote, "The people met their burden of demonstrating good cause for the delay. 19 years of the delay was due to the lack of connection between the semen sample collected at the time of the rape in 1994 and the defendant's DNA profile, which was not developed and uploaded to the law enforcement databases until 2013. Once the police were able to identify a viable suspect, they had a good faith basis to wait until they could locate the victim to arrest the defendant. The detective's hearing testimony established that the police made reasonable and diligent efforts to locate the victim, and the defendant was arrested immediately after a detective located and interviewed the victim. The extent of the delay in prosecution is outweighed by the people's good cause for the delay, the nature of the crime, the fact that there was no period of pretrial incarceration, and the lack of any prejudice from the delay identified by the defendant. We are satisfied that the defendant was not deprived of his due process right to prompt prosecution. So the takeaway here, the 21-year delay between the crime, which was rape, and defendant's arrest in this case was adequately explained. The DNA sample was not connected to a person until nearly 20 years after the rape, and the victim was not located until a year or so after that. That completes part one of this April, May, June 2022 Criminal Law Update CLE. Part one is confined to the April reversal report, April 2022 reversal report. We are now moving to part two of the course, and the written material for that course is the May 2022 Criminal Law Reversal Report.